This sermon is brought to you by Shofar Christian Church. We hope that you will be blessed by this message. Our audio and video sermons are also available on Shofar TV to download and share.
Tonight, I hope to encourage someone. You know, our world is a violent place. It really is a violent place. Aaron's knife on a slide. It's a crazy world. That's an old picture, 1984 picture of the Twin Towers in America. Just as a reminder that our world is really a violent place. And in this world, we have people who wrong others. And sometimes you have to look at yourself in the mirror and say, I am someone who occasionally also wrong others. You know, it's not as though we have victims and perpetrators. We fulfill all those roles. But in this world, we really have people that really are victims. And our world is not very comfortable with using the our social context. It's not very comfortable to talk about victims, people who are victims, because the first thing, if I say I feel like a victim, you'd say, stop feeling that way. You know, you're not a victim. No. You know, the first thing you want to say is get over it. You know, move on. My wife, she has a friend, a colleague who used to work with her in the hospital. She's a doctor, and the colleague said, the colleagues told her a story. She's a psychiatrist, and her husband is a psychologist. I mean, poor kids. It's just wrong. You know, it's like, how can the world is wrong anyway? So this kid, he was 4 years old, very vocal, very able to express himself. This 4 year old said to his dad, "Dad, I feel 5 year old." He said, "Dad, I feel horrible. I feel so down. I feel so dark. I feel so sad." And his dad said, "So how does it feel feeling like that?" He says, "Not nice." And his dad says, "Well, stop it." If it was so simple, the third largest drug prescription in the world would be less popular. Anti-anxiety, antidepressants, you know, so it's something that you go on. But the world is really, our reality in this world is filled with violence. It's a world where people violently, and I mean South Africa, Cape Town, murder capital of the world, we have real people that are real victims of crime. Real victims of crime. And sometimes, you know, if you have people working with you who just stay on the other side of the N1, a little bit into the Cape Flats, then in our conversations, you'd pick up that we live in two different worlds in this one city. I mean, I don't know anyone in our congregation in Delft who hasn't, for the past 18 months, have not been robbed or cell phone taken off in violence or intimidated or pushed over or worse done to them in a short period. You know, our world really, there are real victims. So only thing I want to say with this picture is that our world is really violent. And being a victim is an objective reality. And it's not something that you can just say it's in your head. It is a real thing. Someone wronged another. It is a reality. So having said that, I want to say tonight that I want to talk about not the reality, not the objective reality of being a victim, but the subjective mindset of being in the state of being a victim, victim mentality. And it's something real in our world. It's something very real. I mean, if there's one thing that probably describes the South African ethos, is that we live in a nation on all the sides that suffered trauma and loss and violence because of a wrong injustice in the country. And it has not stopped in 1992, 1995, depending on when your clock started. It didn't stop then. Our country is filled with injustice. So people sitting in this congregation tonight have all suffered some trauma. Everyone. You cannot live in South Africa for a long time without suffering real trauma. I remember we had a friend, a colleague in Pretoria when we planted a church there in Donnell. Came from the States, somewhere in the northwest of America. And she was so shocked and traumatized living with us in Sunnyside in Pretoria. It's lekker, because it was 20 jaar geleden, so it wasn't, it was a little bit better then. Only half the population were Nigerians then, it's now more. But living in the inner city in Pretoria, she was so traumatized that 9 out of the 10 girls in a small group had smash and grab attempted hijackings at robots at traffic lights in a span of 8 months. And she was so traumatized because when she grew up, she knew one person. Just want to give a bit of context. One person in all her life whose car radio was stolen in a town for the first 18 years of her life. And so she landed in Pretoria in the inner city, and she was traumatized. And I want to say, yes, she's not the only one who's traumatized in this nation. We live in a violent society. We live in a violent country. We live in a particularly violent country. There are real people suffering real things. The problem is with the victim mentality, maybe just the next slide, Donkey Ernst, is that people in a victim mindset or victim mentality are stuck in that cycle of trauma emotionally, with the inability to move out, with the inability to move on in life. It's not as though there's something wrong with them being traumatized. They were real victims. You are, we are real victims. Something really happened with us. But the problem is, if you cannot find healing to move on, you'll be stuck where you are. So the victim mindset is someone who's stuck in that reality, someone stuck in the past. You long for the old days. Everything is stuck there. You are discouraged and hopeless. The core issue is the inability to move forward, which means you deny that you have the power to move on. Remember the core thing, how God created mankind. He says, I want to create you in my image. With what? As a powerful creator. I'm a powerful creator, you're a powerful creator, and I give you the power, the authority, the dominion, the power, the authority, like real power to shape and change the world with me, for me. Let's partner in this. We are created as powerful beings in the image of God. The victim mindset denies that I have any power to move on. That is the issue. It denies that I have any power to move on. So we live in despair. We feel numb and defeated. We feel hopeless, vulnerable, self-pity. Self-pity is alive and well in our nation. Self-pity is alive and well within us. We really feel pity for ourselves. We really like to feel pity for ourselves because feeling pity says it's everyone else's fault but mine. Again, I'm not denying real violence. I'm saying being stuck there is not helpful, is less helpful. Okay, so and with that comes a great deal of shame. Shame doesn't say there's something wrong done to me. Shame says I have become something wrong. There's something wrong with me. Not there's something I've run. If you're English or American, you're not going to get that one. So I want to move on. Ernst, skip two slides. Just before we go, I'd just like you to, before we open the Bible, because I'm going to open in John chapter 5. Before we open there, I just want you to look at the previous slide, please, Ernst. No, one after that. Is there one after that? Yes. I want you to take a moment and please do this properly. Like take this 1 minute and do this properly. You've got 1 minute now. Think about your life. Think about every aspect of your life. What does real victory for you in one of those areas look like? Like real change, real victory. Is there a cycle in your life which seems to continue? Is there an area in your life which seems to constantly fail? Is there something in your life which, like failure to launch? I'm not talking about the 40-year-old people in our congregation still living with mom. That's not what I want to talk about. Failure to launch is a real movie, for those who missed it. But I want you to take a moment and just think for a moment. Just apply this before we go into the text. What does real progress look for you in your life? Real victory. Close your eyes. You go to bed tonight. You go to the bathroom first and go to the bed. Check your Facebook status. Check your inbox the last time. Check your dating site status. Did you have any heights? And then you didn't have any. And switch it off. Switch off the light. Say your prayer. Close your eyes. And then Jesus comes and he answers that one prayer of yours. What would the answer to that prayer look like? Just take a moment. What does real victory in one area in your life look like? What is the one thing that you really want Jesus to fix in your life? If your answer is your husband, your wife, or your mother, you should redo the... I'm talking about you. Do you have that? Just keep it there. Let's keep it there. Okay, let's read from John chapter 5. If this was too quick for you, you can do this at home. John chapter 5. I'm really trusting God that this won't be an academic exercise, but a real change encounter with Jesus. John chapter 5 starts with the phrase, after this. Now, after this obviously means there's something important that he did before that. That was Jesus going to the Samaritan village, and he met the lady there at the well. Had a massive encounter. She was stuck in a life cycle of failed relationships, and she was trying to find theological reasons and debates with Jesus about her lifestyle, and Jesus said to her, man, no, let's stop this. I know what's really happening. Let's talk about the real thing here. And she goes like, wow, Jesus, you really know me? And then she had the first one to hear that streams of living water will gush from your innermost being, that God is looking for one people everywhere that worship him in spirit and truth. Amazing revelation of what the real faith is like. And then Jesus went to his hometown in Galilee, where he was rejected by his home country. And that introduces the next section, the second section in the book of John, which is all about conflict with the Jews. This is where we pick up. Jesus comes to Jerusalem for the feast. This is the second year of the reign of Jesus. There's already been three feasts. This is the second year of the reign of Jesus. Probably Passover again. Jesus goes to the feast. Now in Jerusalem, speaking to the Ephesians who were the first recipients of this letter, they didn't know Jerusalem, so he's giving them context. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda. I said it wrong this morning. Bethesda. Naval Hospital for those of you. Anyway, Bethesda, which has five roof colonnades. In these lay, picture this, a multitude, many, many hundreds, a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for miracle. Picture this, hundreds of people lying around a pool waiting for a miracle. No cure to lameness, blindness, disease. They're waiting for the cure. They're waiting, and there's a moving of the water. Now, we don't know whether this happened daily, occasionally, or during feast times such as this. We don't know whether it happened the whole time, but we know that there were real hundreds of people who believed this, and they were there, and they were eager, because life for them did not happen without them. There was no other way out for them. They were stuck in a rut where they were. Their lives were put on hold by some traumatic event, either a sickness, an illness, or an accident many years ago. Maybe they were born this way. But the Bible says there's an angel who went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred the water. Then whoever stepped in first, after the stirring of the water, he was made well, read there in Greek, whole, of whatever disease he had. He would be cured instantaneously. His life would forever be changed. He would no longer be lame, unable to work, unable to contribute with his life. He would no longer be blind, being set off as a beggar forever. He didn't know that. The word Bethesda literally means house of pity. Amazing. What a pitiful state. A house of pity. House of compassion, house of pity. All these people were just lying there. Picture that. Masses of people waiting, hopeless, waiting for a cure. There was one man there, John writes. So there were many people there, but there was one particular man there who had been an invalid for 38 years. Anyone 38 years old, can you just raise your hand? Anyone 38? Okay, I see those hands. I see those hands. It's amazing. For as long, this man, because in John chapter 9, he speaks of a man born blind who was about this age. This man, he doesn't say he was born in this state. So probably had a little bit of life. We don't know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. He had his dreams. He was playing around, running around with his friends, and something happened, whether it was polio, whether it was an accident, whether it was just something bad happened with him, neurological disease. We don't know. But this man has been an invalid. He was lame for 38 years. That's a very long time. Then Jesus saw him lying there, and he knew that he had already been there for a long time. He said to him, listen to this question. Do you want to be healed? Jesus knew that this man was lying on his back for a very long time. Now, whether Jesus had a word of knowledge or whether Jesus just looked at this man and said, you are only skin and bones, and I can see that you've been on this bed for a very, it's just obvious, you've been here for a very long time. We don't know how Jesus knew this, but this man has been down and out. Just before we go to the question of Jesus, John puts this as the third miracle that Jesus did in his gospel. So there were many, many, many miracles. But John puts this as a third one specifically to introduce the section. And when you read 38, five colonnades, pull, and Passover, if you're a Jewish man, you would see pictures because this is how they spoke. You would see that there was a Passover of their forefathers many, many years ago, 1,000 years ago. There was a Passover after being in Egypt for the first Passover, which they came for the feast. And then the Israelites, the Hebrews, the forefathers of these Jews, were saved, delivered with God's great power, brought into the wilderness, and they received the law of God, which Moses composed into five scrolls, five books. The Torah. If you do them, you will live and enter into the promised land. Be made whole. Land of wholeness. Land of wellness. So John is doing something deeper. Apart from telling the story as it is, he highlights certain sections to show parallelism, to show something deep. That Jesus is saying, John is saying, this man's state is the condition of all of Israel, reminding them that there was a time when they also celebrated the Passover feast, but because of their inability to keep the law, inability to go through these five ports, inability to go through these five colonnades into the pool, they were stuck forever and they all died in the wilderness. For 38 years, they were wandering around in the wilderness and the whole nation, all of them died and passed away because of their inability to keep well. And he's saying that this is the mindset of this man. I mean, this man was lying there for 38 years. For 38 years, can you imagine whether the stirring is annually, whether the stirring is on feast days, or whether the stirring of the water is daily? Can you imagine the stirring of the water with hundreds of invalids lying around, and the scene that will happen if this water stirs, and everyone knows this is my one chance to make it. There are hundreds of other people, and these people, none of them could move freely. None of them could run freely. The blind people won't see the stirring of the water. The lame people will need someone to help, but everyone is trying just to crawl into the water, to get into the water, to get a sense of healing, a touch from God, something that will save them. And this is the picture that John is saying that this man had, and he's saying, by the way, this is all of Israel in this instance. He's pointing, saying, your religious mindset will not give you the power to get well. That's his core message. But back to this man. He's there for 38 years. And Jesus says to him, oh, my friend, I can see that you've been here for very, very, wow, can I lie down next to you? Wow, this bed of yours is quite uncomfortable. How long have you been on this? Wow, this is really, really bad. Does your mom know that you're here? Does she not care for you anymore? Ah, oh, she passed away as well. I'm so sorry. And your friends, where are they? Oh, they all left you. This is really bad. This is really, really bad. And tell me, what are your dreams? What did you dream of when you were young? Wow, 38 years. That girl, high school friend of yours left you as well. I'm so sorry about this. Wow, I'm so sorry that you're feeling like this. This is really, really bad. This is really bad. We think that our Jesus will say something like that. Poor you. Shame. Shame. Ai. No. Jesus' question to this man is quite harsh. This is not the first time he asks something that harsh. This is not the first time in Luke chapter 8, he does the same with Bartimaeus and his friend with the blind two blind men. But he asks him, do you want to be healed? Do you want to be healed? And the reason why I obviously talk about the victim mentality in this context, because this is the question, the real question that this man had to hear. Is tell me, You've been here for a very long time, for a very, very long time. Do you really want to be healed? Do you really desire to end the cycle of victimhood in your life? Do you really desire to end this? Or are you quite comfortable to always feel self-pity and everyone caring for you? You've built your whole life around this. This is reality. Real trauma did happen to you. This is real. Real trauma did happen to you. No one's going to deny that. There was a time when you ran away, that you ran with your friends, but now you're here. Jesus doesn't ask him about, was it your sin or my sin? Jesus is not into that now. He's just saying, do you really want to be healed? Do you really want me to change your reality for you? Because I can do this. And it's amazing to me that this man was pointing his whole life into, he had one way sort of getting out this. There was one way for him to go. In his head, the way to get healed was, I have to be the first and no one helps me. And this is his answer. He says, and Jesus asks him, do you want to be to hell? No, that's not what he asks. Do you want to be healed? Afrikaans, verskoon my. And the answer is, I can't. No one helps me. You know, I'm lame. It's really bad. The economy is hectic, and my friends have deserted me. My mom was the worst. I mean, she kicked me out of the house. I mean, that's just hectic. I'm here all alone. No one loves me. No one cares for me. Poor me. Jesus, poor me. Victim mentality. But Jesus asked him, do you want to be healed? I don't ask your state. I want to ask, do you want to be well? Do you want the cycle to end? Or don't you want the cycle to end? Yeah. The reason why I'm probably talking about this, as a pastor, we pray with people and we talk with people. And there are really moments when I hear this from people's mindset. And obviously when I hear this, I take note because I recognize that I'm also a person who also lives in this nation. And I also, there are things in my life which never ever change. And it's always the system's fault or someone else's fault or, you know, God is not smiling on me or something like that. You know, we have these excuses for why we're stuck where we are. The word came tonight about being stuck, while we're stuck where we are. The reality is, this man wanted to be healed in this particular way through his own performance in some way. And Jesus comes to him and says, do you want to be healed? Because I'm standing right next to you. And in reading this text, I'm so aware that in a very special way tonight, that Jesus is standing next to you in the same thing. What is the one thing that you're really trusting God for to end in your life? What is the one thing that you're really trusting God for to continue or to start in your life? What is the one intervention that you're really trusting God for that you have 50,000 excuses for? My wife, my husband, the system, the economy, da, 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 this is why I can't. And we find Christ standing next to us, the Son of God. And this is the irony, obviously, in the picture, yeah? He goes like, oh, I can't do it, I can't do it, and I can't do it. And Jesus like, do you know who I am? Do you have any? And obviously he had no idea who Jesus was at that point. Because we see later when he finds him in the temple, then he has an idea who Jesus is, and then it's amazing. Sir, I can't. I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is being stirred up. You know, I can't do anything. Someone steps in before me, and yes, I'm like a slum, but I'm like no dun. It's all of us. I'm stuck where I am. I don't have the power. I don't have the resources. And I can't. I can't. I want to, but I can't. And then Jesus' word of grace here tonight for this man, but for you as well. He says, man, get up your bed and walk. It's not the first time that Jesus says that to someone. His friends had dropped him. The man with the four friends had dropped him from the roof, brought him to Jesus. The same words. Take up your bed and walk. Take up your bed and walk. Are you stuck where you are? Take up your bed and walk. Trust me. Walk this out. Walk through your miracle. Go through this thing. because the Lord is present. And he says, take up your bed and walk. And he walked. And that once the man was healed, he took up his bed and he walked. Now, that day was a Sabbath day, which introduces the next sentence. The man obviously was in so much trouble that he got healed on a Sabbath day, you know. He got healed on a Sabbath day, and Jesus said to him, take up your bed and your walk. And he was arrested because he was carrying his own bedding on his Sabbath day. And it was unlawful to carry your own bedding on a Sabbath day. He was arrested. Later, we find the man in the temple joining the feast. Get it? I love this picture. This man was unable to have any joy in life or to participate in any feasting for 38 years, not just because he couldn't walk there, but as a lame man, he was not welcome in the temple. And the Lord did a full restoration. When Jesus does healing miracles in the Bible, it's never, ever just about the healing miracle. I love it. That woman who was... We had the flow of blood for 12 years. Her whole identity and everything in her life was formed around the fact that she was once suffering from a flow of blood, which means she was ceremonially impure for everyone. She could never attend any feast, never attend any Sabbath day, never attend any temple thing, and never be in any group with any men ever for 12 years of her life. And obviously we know about the story because she was in trouble because she touched a man. She touched Jesus. And immediately she was healed. But again, the issue was there, not just that it was her blood flow. Her whole life, her whole identity was formed around the fact that she had this disability. She was stuck. She was stuck in victimhood because I am this. We know the same story about the blind man, Bartholomew and his friend, the same thing. He was a beggar for all of his life until Jesus healed him. And obviously, it was not just the fact that he was healed, but everything about his life changed because of that one thing that Jesus touched him in. Everything about his life. It's not just his sight. It's not just that he could see. He was cut out of society forever. The lepers that Jesus healed every single time, or the blind man, John chapter 9, who was blind and then he could see, that whole story that we know so well, the demon-possessed men in Gadara, the demoniac, Mark chapter 5, or the lame and the dumb, the deaf and dumb man in Mark chapter 1. It's not just that Jesus heals the person and all of a sudden there's a physical healing that happened. It's a complete restoration. This was the invitation that Jesus said to this man. Not, do you want to walk again? Do you want to be whole again? Do you want to be whole? And this is not an issue of salvation. You know this. This man was a son of Abraham. It's not as though this is a salvation that you want. Do you want to get saved? Put up your hand right now. Oh, can't, Jesus, I'm lame. It says, okay, I see your heart, you know. It's not just that it's not a salvation thing. The issue is, and I want you to hear me now from my heart. The issue is, are you going to walk out the fullness of your purpose, or will you be stuck in this forever? This was the invitation. The invitation is not just, do you want to walk and play football? It's like, do you want to fulfill your purpose in life? Because this thing has you bound forever. Do you want to continue like that, or don't you want to continue? Are you happy with the way in which you organized your life and with the fact that everyone feels pity for you? Because aramayay, shame, aramayay, freifirachi, I shame, always dependent. You know, we do that little victim drama triangle thing, you know, someone's persecuting me, I'm a poor victim, and someone's constantly rescuing me. Always relating your relationships because someone is against me or someone is helping me. If your life is organized in such a way, in any part of your life, then Jesus is asking you tonight, do you want to be well? Do you want to be well for God's sake? Do you want to be well so that you can fulfill what God has called you to be? Do you want to be fully well so that you can live out the purpose which God has for you? Because the Lord has a purpose with your life. And being stuck in a mat in some way, being stuck in victim mentality for some way, is not going to help you in that. It's not going to help you like that. So Jesus is saying, do you want to be well? I just want to get to that identity thing again, just to backtrack a little bit. You know, if there's an area of my life, of one's life, which if there's an unsettled wound, if there's an area that you're always living in response to, you know, you're always defending that thing. I see people that are either because it's a sickness or because it's a mental condition or it's because of a relational rejection thing, you know, some knock that you took in life. You know, everyone goes through stuff, eh? All of us go through stuff. But there are certain things which just sort of, ons hak daar. You know, not everything. Can I pause for a second? So we have this. We have these friends in Pretoria. We moved from a church in Pretoria many years ago. Chantel must still testify, so I must cut it short tonight. Moved from friends in Pretoria. Chantel knows our friends. And we asked our friends, they had a baby, and we just was on the phone with them. And so we said, how's it going with so-and-so? And the answer was, no, very difficult, like everything else in life. That phrase, underline it, mark it in red, and write down, victim mentality. Life is difficult. Nothing works out for me. Nothing ever works for me. I'm always, you know, I'm always have to respond and I always have to move out because my life doesn't work for me. So when there's something like that in your life, let me just get an example. My dad passed away when I was 6 years old. Eh? You know the story. Many of you know the story. Mom was 30 years old or just before 30. Three boys, 4, 6, 8. Moved from the Northern Cape, small Plattelandse dorpie, to Johannesburg to sort of relocate there and to restart with living, start with school and stuff like that. And obviously, I didn't plan for my dad passing away. And my dad passing away wasn't my fault. It's not as though I did anything wrong with that. It had a massive impact on my life. Obviously, I was a young man. And it's not just that dad passed away. It's typically with these things, your whole life changes. Small Plattelandse Noordkaap dorpie. Everyone think my mom is the pre-primary creche tunny. It was her little creche there. We had to pack that up because we had to move closer to family, and the family was in Joburg, and she could find a job. She had to work full days now and not half day anymore. And we had to be in a... It's not so sad. It's like the reality of many people, but it had a massive impact on me. There was a massive limtown uncertainty. I said this morning, only years later did I recall that I actually went I saw a child psychologist for quite some time because I had stomach ulcers at the age of 7 years old because I couldn't handle the pressure, you know? Because one very well-meaning uncle of mine said to me in a loving way, Ross, you have to be strong now. You have to be the man in the house to take care of your mom. So I tried the best I can as a 7-year-old in a new city to take care. I don't know what that meant, but I took that upon myself. So obviously, didn't cope that well. But that set obviously a few years, 4 years of not having a male figure. And we're having many male figures in my mom's house in a good way. My mom was a really, so was hot. So was a really beautiful, very beautiful 30-year-old woman, really beautiful. And obviously the three young boys didn't make it easy for these young gentlemen to visit her. So we did not receive the gifts coming into these men, potential dads coming into the home. One eventually made it. He's amazing. So he married my mom. But there were quite a few years, and obviously the setting time wasn't difficult. Short story, I grew up with just a gap in my growth spurt, just not having a male figure there, and obviously with a dad coming, dad 2.0, coming into our home, really doing amazing. But there was a gap that I registered. It's nothing, not a gap in him, but it was a gap in me. So I grew up with this desiring men, older men, to approve of me, to say that I'm okay. You know, because obviously at 7 years old, I failed. I wasn't good enough to be a man in my... So I had that desire constantly. And this is what I want to say. My whole identity was shaped around this performance to please and to show that I'm good enough and man enough. Straight throughout my high school years, straight throughout my Air Force time, at varsity especially. And obviously you're a real man if the girls really like you and they approve of you, and if the male teachers and male role models in your life sort of approve of you. Until... I think my fifth year. This is the best 2 years of my life. Anyway, so my second last year, we went on a, Dale, I don't know, that one you weren't with us, but we went on a Go SA trip, a mission trip around the country for the third time. And the pastor couldn't lead anymore, and I was asked with Antoinette, my friend, that the two of us should lead this mission trip around the country for 40 days, preaching in churches, preaching on beaches, doing stuff, taking a team of 22 students along with us on the road. And I just felt so intimidated. And this is the irony, obviously. Oh, I wanted this because I'm proved that I'm good enough. And then when you get it, I absolutely know that I'm not good enough. So sink into a pit there and go to my room and crack before God and say, God, I can't do this. God, I can't do this. God, help me. And just the Lord in a very loving way just sternly rebuked and quieted me and said to me, Ross, Genesis chapter 1. And I said to the Lord, Lord, I know the book. In the beginning, you created, and you said, the Lord said, read it. And I read out loud, and coming to verse 3, and I said there would be light. I just had a massive encounter, and Jesus said to me, stop. And said to me, I said, let there be light, and there was light. And I say, yes, God, you create with your mouth. And then the Lord said to me, sort of coming to my face, saying, I said, you're the leader. And I go like, okay, God, I get it. I'm the leader. It's not as though I have to be, make it. Your words are creative and powerful. And it was a massive transformation moment for me, which changed the cycle of living in victimhood because I didn't have a dad who loved me. I didn't have a dad who cared for me. I didn't have a dad. And my excuse was always like, well, I didn't have a dad. And like God, it's the reason why I'm struggling with lust is because I didn't have a male figure in my life. God, I couldn't, God, I'm not good enough. And God, what should I, you know, this whole insecurity that I lived with for so many years was because it's not my fault. My dad passed away and it's your fault that my dad passed away. That type of thing. Until the Lord said to me, hey, get up and walk. So to me, he said, hey, you are the leader. I create you. And I can't, I wish you would have known me before that. But obviously, there's a massive character shifts we'd had to happen since then. I wasn't a good person in many ways. But there's so many shifts that happened on that day because I knew that my Father in God believed in me and that he made me a leader. It was a massive confidence shift, moving from a cycle of insecurity and always looking for approval and always wanting someone just to applaud me and being good and stuff like that and just waiting for that, yes, yes, amazing, oh, wow, you know, walking away when someone does not say that and you go like, I wonder whether it was, well, sure, I hope it was okay geweest and replaying everything, going, oh, you're such an idiot because you didn't do that. That whole insecurity vibe was transformed in a moment when the Lord said to me, hey, you are the leader. I called you. And it's a massive moment which happened. So I had my transformation moment from that cycle, and there are many more, but that cycle of victimhood, of me having lost my father and therefore always having an excuse because I didn't have a dad, you know, and I grew up for how many years without a male model in my life or someone who cared or someone who kicked the ball with me and stuff like that, to that moment. And it was a moment when I met with Jesus, just like this man, who heard the Lord saying to me, Seem, get up, take your bed and walk. I want to stop there for a moment and just say, there's something else in this story. So the first transformation moment in this story is the man who had an encounter with Jesus. I want you to see, first of all, that he wasn't looking for Jesus. In fact, even while Jesus was standing next to him, he had no idea that the Son of God was standing next to him. He had no idea that the Son of God was standing next to him. He was just trying to do what he always does and find pity from a man, maybe to get money, maybe to get food, maybe to get carried the next time the water gets stirred. He was simply just showing his need for compassion to the stranger standing next to him. But see how Jesus comes to him in his moment of need. Now the question probably is, why to this man? And I want to say probably because this man was ready to take up his bed and walk. Probably he was ready to take up his bed and walk. It was his God moment. It was this one moment when Jesus walked to him. When Jesus asked him, he didn't give the right answer. There was no right answer from him. In fact, it's a bit ironic. He's missing the whole point of the conversation. Like in so many of the gospel account questions, people don't, biblical answer. People never give the right answers to Jesus when he asks them questions. And Jesus never answers them the questions they ask him in the gospel. He says, you missed the point. That's all he's saying. But he gets this one. So the first transformation moment is him responding and Jesus saying, take up your bed. Please note that Jesus does not say to him, walk and leave the past behind. It's amazing, eh? Because it's a massive shift. Just like the man who was dropped into the house when Jesus was, the answer was the same. Jesus said, take up your bed and walk. So obviously for my kids, I would say, see, Jesus always says, make up your bed before you go out of the room. It's twisting the story as good effect. Cleanliness is next to godliness, you know, we can say that. But the point is obviously not that. The point is the same as in Psalm 40, where the point of God's healing miracle is for you to walk around with your bed. This man was known for 38 years, not by everyone, because he was obviously living in some corner there where no one saw him. But for 38 years of his life, this man was lying down on his bed. His bed was what supported him. His bed was his home. His bed was the thing that held him captive. It was his prison for 38 years. That is the one thing that characterized him as someone unable to participate in society, as someone being a victim. For 38 years, he was stuck there. And then Jesus says to him, take up your bed and walk. Roll that thing up, put it under your arm, and walk as a testimony to everyone. Ask them, why on earth are you walking around with your bed? And we go like, let me tell you the story. This is my story. This is my song. Let me tell you about my Savior all the day long. Come on, this is my story. You know, Psalm 40 is so beautiful to me. And I want to say this to us here today, because many of us have stories of God's intervention in our lives. Constant. Wait, tomorrow. Many of us have stories of God in our lives who has done great things for us. And those stories are stuck somewhere. I said this morning, I'm not going to ask you hashtag I'm staying. How many of you are following the Facebook page hashtag I'm staying? Okay, don't say no. Because even if you don't have, but for, you know, the reason why in 6 weeks' time, we have 750,000 followers that don't want to miss those posts is because of the need, the drastic need for hope. People want to hear a story that is it possible for a lady who is born in a shack without a mom in Limpopo province somewhere without water? Is it possible for her to have her own business and be flourishing? And then this lady says, you know what's amazing? I just decided that I'm not going to be stuck like this forever. All I had was one chicken, and I sold it, and I bought two. And then I started, and today she delivers 300 chickens a day to her audience, and she employs a few people because she believes. Or that those little ladies with the chilies, you know. Like, I see that you haven't read those. But it's amazing, you know. It's like, only had $100 eats, and they decided, what will we do with this all-pay $100 that we have? And they buy chilies, and eventually today they are delivering to Woolies and to many other franchises and exporting some chilies with their massive business, employing so many people, because it's possible for God to turn a victim into a victor. It is possible for God to do this. And those stories do something. And that's why I like that page. But the same for you. When Jesus says, take up, walk, he says, take your bed with you. You need to tell the story. You need to tell the story of God's greatness.
Thank you for listening. Remember that our sermon audio and videos are also available on Shofar TV. Go to www.shofaronline.tv to download and share.